with a public hearing on House Bill 2245. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members
of the committee, House Bill 2245 comes to you at the request of the Office of Legislative Counsel's Office. Allows Legislative Counsel to change a geographic reference without specific legislation in statute if the Oregon Geographic Names Board and United States Board of Geographic Names has approved the name change. This is a bill that was heard in the House Judiciary Committee.
Okay, and the need for this is?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is flexibility. Last session there was a bill passed, for example, you can't use the term squaw in public names now, okay? You may remember that bill from last session. And there are in places where I understand, like, for example, in the Deschutes National Forest, that name is used a couple hundred times. I remember the testimony in the House side, and that this would just allow greater flexibility when they come across this name. And pursuant to the statute, the Legislative Council may substitute for a term in statute that designates a geographic place any term for a geographic place that is approved by the Oregon Geographic Names Board and the United States Board of Geographic Names. So if both of these entities have approved the name change, Legislative Council's Office, when it's doing the draft or doing an amendment to statute, comes across that change, it can do so to be in conformance with these two.
Okay. We don't have a single soul signed up for or against this, so are there any questions of council? Senator Pruzanski.
Thank you. Bill, regarding the two entities that make the decision with the and, does that require both of them to buy off on it? And I question if it does. Does the United States Board of Geographic Names comment or pass any type of measure that involves stuff that's just within Oregon?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Pruzanski, the way I read it, yes, it would require both of them, but I do remember doing some research on my own when this bill was before the House, and I have in my file the web page from the United States Board of Geographic Names. And the United States Board of Geographic Names is the interagency board established by public law to standardize geographic spellings for use in U.S. government publications. And they have a relationship with entities in every state of the union. I'm looking at Wisconsin State Geographic Names Council. Let me go to Oregon. Oregon Geographic Names Board is Mr. John C. Pierce, Ph.D., Secretary, Oregon Geographic Names Board at 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. And I think when I made a phone call, they are connected with the Oregon Historical Society. You will find one in every state of the union. If I'm going through this the last time, they do this in conjunction with each other. They have a working relationship.
It looks to me like the Oregon Geographic Names Board feeds information to the...
The gentleman who just raised his hand there, Madam Chair.
Would you come up and enlighten us? Thank you.
Members of the committee, may I approach?
Please. Identify yourself.
Mike McArthur, I'm a member of the Oregon Geographic Names Board. To Senator Pruzanski's question, Madam Chair, the Oregon Geographic Names Board only recommends to the National Board changes. It must be approved by the National Board.
I see. So it wouldn't be a case of one saying one thing and one saying the other thing.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Does that answer your question?
Just one other question, if I could. If the Oregon Geographic Names Board comes up with some change, it sounds to me from what I'm hearing is that it's then submitted to the United States Board of Geographic Names for their subsequent approval?
Madam Chair, Senator Pruzanski, yes, I believe that's the procedure, the way it works.
What if they chose not to approve something that we forward them from the Oregon Geographic Names Board? Where would that leave us?
Madam Chair, Senator Pruzanski, then it wouldn't change.
It sounds like we recommend it and they give final approval, and unless they approve it, it can't go through.
Right. Madam Chair, I'd only bring that to the committee's attention as to whether that's something, I mean, it sounds like things work very well together, but if that's something that's going to hinder the state from being able to carry out whatever its, policy is that may be contrary to whatever might be on the national level.
Well, but I think this would make it easier to change the names. If you change it by statute, that would change it. I mean, that would be binding in Oregon. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, not yet. As I understand, not necessarily. And I know this a bit from the local government perspective. When it has to do with the geographic feature, the local government doesn't have the authority to make those changes. They must be submitted to the Oregon Geographic Names Board, which then submit it to the National Board.
Well, but if we pass a statute renaming Rooster Rock to Haystack Rock, that would be binding on that, wouldn't it?
Madam Chair, I would clarify that, I believe, if I were you.
Madam Chair, it may not make a difference. It just seems to me that we've got it set up where we're going to require that approval, and if there is something on a political sense that was not acceptable or willing to be accepted at the national level, we may not be able to do whatever we want to. Now, of course, the example that's in the summary is pretty obvious as to what you expect, but there may be something there. I just wanted to get something on the record so we know that we may not actually have complete control of destiny.
Well, we certainly don't, but this says, this will give more flexibility because it says in the summary that a geographic name can only be changed now by legislative action. So I suppose the process under that would be the legislature changes it and then the federal board has to approve it. Is that the process as you understand
it? I'm sure that'd be my guess.
Okay. Senator Byer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was asked a series of questions, and I don't know who's the best person to answer them, but could you give me an idea how many geographic names are actually in statute? Because I just looked up in the index for squaw, because that's what's, referred to here in the background, and that is not listed in the index. So I don't know how many are we talking about that are actually, because these are geographic names. These are names that are on maps. These are not and road names. How many of those are actually in statute?
Do you know the answer to that, Council?
Madam Chairman of the Committee, Brendan McCarthy from Legislative Council's office, if he were here, I could address that more directly. I did some name searches myself, and I did find SCOR probably, I think, a half dozen times.
But as a geographic name, or just in another context?
I think it was, you've got to remember, this is going back to February, early February. I think it was in references. It wasn't SCOR. I did find other names that were geographically referenced in statute.
We have legislative counsel here. Are you here on this?
He's here, Madam Chair. Connie's here in the next bill.
Madam Chair, well, I do have a bit of a message relating to that. Harrison Connolly, Deputy Legislative Counsel for the record, and though I was to give Mr. Taylor the message that sorry Brendan was called to another committee, he will come this way as quickly as he can.
Okay.
I don't have specific information on that detail.
Okay, thank you. I think we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2245 and take it up later this meeting as soon as Mr. McCarthy comes. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2256. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2256 comes to you from the Office of Legislative Counsel. It identifies the scope of application of certain definitions relating to chattel mortgages, those are mortgages on personal property as opposed to real property.
Okay, now you're here on this one as well.
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
I don't know if you have to re-identify yourself, but why don't you just be safe?
Okay, Harrison Connolly, Chief Deputy Deputy Legislative Counsel. And should I just introduce this generally, or did you have questions about the bill?
Do you have anything to add to what counsel said, and then we can...
Well, I think he described it fairly accurately. This was a statute. Usually when we define terms, we define them very clearly for the section or the series or the chapter or for all of the statutes. And in this case, at whatever time that these definitions were originally drafted, they did not have that indication. I thought you might also be curious, something that we did not really fix in this bill, but that first basic piece of bold language relating to recording and file. I thought that maybe Dee Berman of the county clerks was going to be here, and she could probably tell you more clearly what's happening. We have not really attempted to fix that in this draft.
But what happens in that office is some documents are required of the statute to be recorded, some are required to be filed, and that leads to some internal processes, some internal differences in their offices as to how those documents are indexed or maintained. So this is a provision where apparently we've been a little sloppy over time describing whether a document was to be filed with the office or to be recorded with the office of the county clerk. So this provision gives them the leeway to do the appropriate recording or filing as necessary. One of the bills, which I think you may have seen, was a fix to several of the provisions that may inadvertently say file when they should say record and inadvertently say record when they should say file. So we really have not attempted to address that here other than to be very clear that this provision applies throughout the statutes.
Oh, I thought I understood it, and now I'm confused. what is not being fixed here, and does it need to be fixed?
I'm sorry, you're right. I probably did go too far with that. Essentially, all we're doing is we're making very clear what portion of the statutes to which these definitions apply. The definition in one applies throughout the statutes. The other definitions apply only in Chapter 205.
Okay. Do we have any questions from the committee?
Yeah.
Senator Beyer?
I don't see any difference between what is being proposed here and what current law says. And somebody has to explain to me, because if you look at what current law says, the sub 2 is being removed. It's recorded, recording, or record. We're using the reference to chattel mortgage in the statutes of the state being recorded or filed, recording or filing, or record or filed, as the context may require. That's almost verbatim the word that's being inserted above.
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, you're right. That was I was anticipating that question, and I started answering it before it was asked. The only differences here, the only substantive differences are in line 5, we have said, as used in the statutes of this state. We were silent as to where this was true previously. Also, the lead-in in line 8, as used in this chapter, these terms are defined.
So that limits it to chapter
205 in this case, 205.
So before...
For example, there is a definition of person in chapter 174. It applies throughout the statutes. If we had this this definition here and it was silent as to what it applied to, which essentially led to a conflict. We're saying in this chapter... I beg your pardon?
A conflict with what?
What I indicated is that in Oregon Revised Statutes, Chapter 174, we have a definition of the term person. That's the second term defined here. The definition for person in Chapter 175 explicitly says that it applies throughout the statutes.
Got it. Yeah, I see.
We would have created a conflict by having this definition that did not limit itself to the chapter. So in this chapter, person is defined this way, but everywhere else in statute, person means what it says in chapter 171.
Okay.
That is the only fix here. But I did start talking about the distinction in subsection 1 between recording and filed as it applies to the county clerk's office. And I could try to repeat that to clarify for
Senator Biden. What this says is that recorded or filed, you're saying that these definitions mean or only apply to chapter 205. So you could have other chapters.
Those apply throughout the statutes.
Right.
That's in reference to chattel mortgages.
Oh, I see.
But
line 8 is the thing. Because I was trying to figure, it looks like person still added by putting line 8 in there where it says as used in this chapter.
I see.
We have limited the scope of that definition.
Right.
The definition in number 1 had no limitation either, and we're saying that, in fact, that applies throughout the statute in relation to chattel mortgages.
Okay.
That makes sense now.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, I think just to make it's not the person of a, it's not the record in, recorded, and record that's being changed. It's the definition of person, text, and transaction that's being changed by this bill.
Limited.
Well, no, on Chair Burdick, Senator Barr, on line 5, we're saying that, in fact, that definition, this discussion about recording and file, applies wherever recording and file are used in the statutes in relation to chattel mortgages.
But, Madam Chair, on line 13, it said the same thing.
It did not say where it was used, where it applied.
It's not limited just to Chapter 205 for the recording.
I understand that, but on Chapter 13, line 13, the words that are being removed stand in the statutes of this state. So you have the exact same meaning for record, recorded, or recording.
You're correct. You're right. Then you're right. The change is only the one on 8. You're right.
Right. It's just moving it up where you identify the ones from this, the chapter, like you said earlier.
So the staff member summary is somewhat incorrect, I guess, because it's the definition of person, text, and transactions are being limited, whereas the definition of those things now in sub 1 will remain the same as current law.
Yeah, and basically they add the phrase as used in the statutes of the state in reference to a chattel mortgage. So they're being broad in the first part, and then they were broad in the original statute, but now they're being specifically broad, and then they're limiting the definition of person,
text, and transaction.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Sorry for being late.
You're just in time.
Yeah, I know.
You're just in time.
But who's the proponent of this bill?
Chair Burdick, Senator Ringo, this was a request of the Legislative Council Committee, essentially our office. We were just trying to do a cleanup here that we thought was necessary. So there is no...
There was no interest group suggesting this change?
No. What happens is, of course, in the 6 months or so immediately following session, we will go to integrate your changes in law into the next edition of the Oregon Revised Statute. That involves reading these chapters a couple of times, and we sometimes recognize errors and oversights, omissions in that process. And so I think we asked for several bills this time to fix some of those errors and omissions, things that were larger than revisers' bills issues. I mean, they're potentially a substantive change, so that we did not want to hide it in the revisers' bill. We wanted you to see it specifically.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Any more questions? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2256. Open a work session on House Bill 2256. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2256 to the floor with three pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2256 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Pruzanski, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
Okie dokie. We will now... We can skip this one. Nancy wants to wait, so we'll go to this one. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2275. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill, House Bill 2275 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission. It clarifies that a later day issued child support judgment supersedes an earlier issued child support order under certain circumstances.
Okay, we have signed up Wendy Johnson and Shani Fuller. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Wendy Johnson. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. House Bill 2275 is a follow-up bill to a couple of bills the Judiciary Committee had last session, House Bill 2645 and 2277. Those bills that stop the problem of having child support orders entered for the same family in both the administrative setting as well as the courts. And this is a follow-up bill to take care of one of the problems that came up with that bill, basically to make it more fair to parents who are relying on the old system and on an old judgment. It does come to you with unanimous vote from the House, as well as the House Judiciary Committee. And Shani Fuller from the Child Support Program will testify on the specifics of the bill.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Shani Fuller, and I'm with the Oregon Child Support Program with the Department of Justice. And we are the ones that asked for this fix here several months back. And House Bill 2645 in the 2003 legislative session fixed a longstanding problem for us in terms of reconciling when a court judgment was entered on top of an administrative child support order and did not modify that child support order. Prior to that time, the child support program treated a later in time court judgment as superseding that earlier in time administrative support order. Quite frankly, under anticipated how many of those we had on our system. And so when we went to implement House Bill 2645, we found that we had numerous cases where this had occurred, and applying the new law to those cases would work as substantial injustice for those parties in certain circumstances. What happens under the new law is that you reconcile the arrears after determining the controlling child support provisions, and the higher of those two amounts is what the party will be responsible for since the date of entry of those orders. And so if we have been enforcing for that lower order all this time, then the party is going to be responsible for that higher amount of arrears going back. And we did not think that was fair to the parties, given that we have been enforcing it and taking this action. And so we went to the Oregon Law Commission and asked for a fix, basically to exempt the cases prior to January 1, 2004, from the applicability of House Bill 2645 and the new laws. And that is what Section 1 of your bill does. Section 2 and 3 clarifies the reconciliation of arrears process. In talking with people about the bill, we found, or the concept at that point, we found that there was a lot of confusion over how that reconciliation of arrears process occurred. So Section 2 and 3 is basically clarification language to clarify the intent of that law. And that is that if you have two orders, you cross-credit those provisions. So if there was an order for $300 and an order for $200, the party is responsible for $300, not the aggregate of those two amounts. They're not responsible for $500 going back. You cross-credit those two orders. And that's what the clarifications in Section 2 and 3 do. And I'm happy to answer any questions on any of that.
Could you, I didn't understand too well about Section 1, what you're trying to do there, grandfathering in. Could you just describe that again? That didn't come through.
Sure. Chair Burdick, for the most part, it's in Section 1, Paragraph 2 on Line 8 there, and it says, notwithstanding the provisions of ORS 25089, 081, and 416448, those are the governing child support provisions that say that you're going to do a controlling, basically a controlling order determination between these two orders. Notwithstanding that law, if two child support judgments involving the same obligor and the same child were entered, the administrator, that's the Oregon Child Support Program, was providing services, and the later issued child support judgment was entered before January 1, 2004, then we're going to exempt those from this law. And what's going to happen is it's going to terminate the provisions of that earlier in time administrative order as of the time the court judgment was entered. And so, for example, we took an administrative order and it's running along at $300 a month. At some point down the line, a court judgment was entered. It didn't modify that administrative order, but enters a child support amount of $200. We, the child support program, put that new order on the system and began enforcing at $200. And the effect of this would say that administrative order for $300 a month was terminated as of the date that court judgment was entered.
Senator Burdick, if I might add,
the bill that we passed last session says that the first order is the one that controls. So we don't have this encouragement of going to get another order, but it works an injustice that the child support program has been enforcing the later order.
Oh, I see.
And so this corrects that. If the child support program was enforcing the later order, that's the order that will be enforced, not the first one, as the bill would, the last year's bill would say, you follow the first order generally, unless it was a modification or something.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. Are you done? Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Seems fairly straightforward. We have no other witnesses signed up. Does anybody else want to testify? Close the hearing on House Bill 2275. And I think we'll open a work session on House Bill 2275. Senator Starr?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2275 to the floor for the pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2275 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Ringo, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
Oh, no. Excuse me. That's a Walker bill. Oh.
She didn't vote.
I noticed that she didn't jump up and down and scream, Senator Walker.
I didn't, Madam Chair.
Okay.
But I will happily carry.
We have Mr. McCarthy here, so we will reopen the hearing on House Bill 2245 and try to get to the bottom of this geographic names issue.
Dun, dun,
dun, dun. Welcome to the committee. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brendan McCarthy from Legislative Council. Sorry for the delay. I was over in the House Water Committee, so they called first, so I wasn't playing favorites.
Okay. We wanted to know what the process is for changing a name. In other words, if the state Oregon Geographic Names Board makes a recommendation, the United States Board on Geographic Names does not accept it, what happens? And under existing law, the name changes have to be by statute, and we wanted to find out if the United States Board on Geographic Names also has to approve the statute. The statutory change?
Well, as to the first question, I believe the answer is nothing. If the U.S. Geographic Names Board does not approve the name, then it drops back to us to come up with a new name. Looking into this process, it is a sort of an odd process. There's the Oregon Geographic Names Board is a bunch of volunteers. The U.S. Geographic Names Board doesn't appear to move very quickly either. And some of these renaming processes take years, which is part of the problem why we have this bill in front of us. The difficulty is that if there is this name in statute, I assume that if the U.S. board approves a name, then they don't also need to approve the statute.
But if we change Rooster Rock to Haystack Rock and sent that and put that in statute, would that name be final?
Generally speaking, that would be final for our purposes, although it's my understanding that the U.S. board is the board that determines the names for all of these places all around the country. So in a sense, there would be this conflict between what was the official name, Rooster Rock, and what we had decided to change it to, Haystack Rock. Now, we could change all the signs on the highway and tell everyone that it was Haystack Rock. But the USGS maps that got issued and any sort of official documentation would continue to read Rooster Rock, thus, I suppose, spawning some sort of confusion.
So when we took the word squaw out of some of these locations, what happened to that? I mean, did that get sent to the United States Board on Geographic Names for... I don't understand.
As it stands, I think we had a direction to remove squaw, and That is fine if we can remove squaw from statute without causing a problem. However, the actual name of those places continues to be squaw. And this, in particular, this Squaw Creek over in Deschutes County, I think, and it continues to be named Squaw Creek, and it's quite an offensive term. And so there are ongoing negotiations to rename that feature. Now, when that feature does get renamed, I think actually Squaw Creek
camped there.
Sorry?
That's a place we know because we've camped there.
Yeah.
And so what you're telling us, even though we may have changed it, it still hasn't been changed officially on the maps and through the board.
Senator Prozanski, Madam Chair, that's correct. And I don't think we've actually changed it. I think it actually still appears in statute as Squaw Creek. It's been a while since I did this bill, but that was my recollection. I think if you do a search for Squaw Creek, it's there.
So if we change it in statute, then the Oregon Geographic Names Board would have to see what we did, and they make the recommendation?
No, Madam Chair, they make the recommendation, I think, irrespective of what we change it to in statute. They're sort of the volunteer board to determine the names of geographic name places.
So
we don't have statutes that say, you know, the name of this creek in Deschutes County that feeds into the Metolia shall be called the Squaw Creek. They're more because they're a reference to a geographic place. We don't really name geographic places in statute. We don't say that, you know, that rock out there sitting in the Columbia River shall be known as Rooster Rock, but we just have things like Rooster Rock State Park or so it is an odd situation, Madam Chair. I don't disagree. I suppose if we were to tell the Geographic Names Board to go forth and name Squaw Creek Ishiskin Creek rather than Squaw Creek, they might go ahead and do that and submit that name to the feds.
Well, you know what? This bill just says if they go through their little process and the federal board eventually gets around to changing the names, this gives legislative counsel to reflect that change in the statute without specific legislation. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. And Committee, give me some guidance here. Senator Byrd.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I got a whole bunch of questions about it I'd like to get answered. And first was how many geographic names are actually in statute? Because I think that's probably fairly rare where we have geographic names in statute.
Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I did find my notes because I know you asked this earlier, Senator, because this is actually the first bill that was carried on the House floor. So you can understand what went on there. But the term squaw is actually used 12 times in statute.
But this bill doesn't just refer to squaw. It's any geographic name that gets changed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Bayer, right, it says the legislative council may substitute a term in statute that designates a geographic name place, you know, if those other two bodies agree. I also have something, and I did some research on this on the Internet, and some of these questions that you asked, even after my research, I couldn't answer. But, for example, it says here from what I found off the Internet is the United States Bureau of Geographic Names does not approve names, it just collects them. I could never completely close the circle. So my assumption is the gentleman that talked earlier how often do we talk about this subject and have someone who's inadvertently here? I don't think he was here directly for that bill. who's on the board, and you know, he said they make recommendations to the federal United States Board of Geographic Names. So,
what happens if we don't pass this bill?
Madam Chair, then when a name of a geographic place gets altered, we have to wait for a legislative session and hopefully have a bill that goes through the process and gets signed by the governor just to change that statute. And sometimes I think that these bills, like this one, generate an awful lot of conversation even though there's no real substantive difference. It's just, this bill is an attempt to deal with the legislative mandate that we had from two sessions ago to change these names, and the slow, glacially slow process apparently that it is to actually change one of these names. And
Senator Byer, you have a follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the next one would be, is there any other place that legislative council can just change statute without us passing a bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, no, unless you give it to us. We do it very cautiously. We usually use those provisions in name change statutes when we're changing the name of a department to another department, and we ask that the legislative assembly give us that authority in case we've missed a few, and we can go forth and change those to the new name. But we are very mindful of the fact that we are not the body, and we hate to go forth and make changes to statute because we're not the body.
And then, Chair, how often does LC reprint the statutes?
Every
2 years after session?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, that's correct.
I have concerns with this bill because of that. I mean, at first it allows legislative council to change statute without legislation, and they don't reprint it anywhere until after we've had legislation. So if a name gets changed, a geographic name, which I think are quite rare in statute, they could be put into the Scribner's bill or whatever these other bills that no one reads anyway, and says that... and say that, you know, we've changed these statutory names because the name of that geographic object has been changed. It seems like that's the way to do it rather than, because how is the public going to know otherwise that the name has been changed?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, if I could just address the Scrivener's bill there for a second. We thought about that and determined that this would be enough of a substantive change. It would require a separate bill, which is why we've pursued this avenue. That was the prevailing opinion in the office as to why this wouldn't go in the revisor's bill.
I guess I agree that this bill is a substantive change, but if you took a name of a geographic object that has been changed by these two boards and included every reference to that name in statute in a Scribner's bill, I don't think that it is controversial to change the name of that object in statute.
Senator Pruszynski.
Madam Chair, I apologize for asking the very first question about the "and" between lines 6 and 7.
But apology not accepted.
But with that said, I mean, clearly all we're going to do is give legislative council the opportunity to make a change in statutes that designates a geographic place that has already been basically changed by this volunteer board and approved by the U.S. board.
Right. And Senator Barr, you made the point of you wouldn't have a problem with putting it in the Scribner's bill, but I think they would need this authority to put it in the Scribner's bill. Is that how you would do it? You'd put it in the Scribner's bill?
Madam Chair, we would, if we knew about it, we would probably go ahead and put it in the revisor's bill without this authority. But again, the overriding principle and rule on the revisor's bill itself is whether that change is non-substantive and non-controversial. And while I can agree that this would be probably non-controversial, the prevailing opinion was in the office that it was not non-substantive.
I can see where it's non-controversial, but I can also see the point where we may not need that. I mean, if you have the authority to put it in the Scrivener's bill for to incorporate changes that are made at a glacial pace anyway, that there's not very many of them in the statutes, that may be enough. So what I'd like to do is I'm going to close the public hearing, and I would like you to get back to me if we have just tons and tons of these in the statutes that you really need this authority because it's just fast-breaking news at all times, then that would be a different issue. Senator Winfrey.
Madam Chair, this bill gives yet another unelected entity authority to change names with the ebb and flow of politically correct thought.
No, it doesn't give any authority to anybody to change names.
It certainly takes it away from the legislature.
No, it just allows them to incorporate names that are changed through our existing process.
And as I read it currently, that legislature is required to assertion is required to make that change, and this would eliminate that. Our next going to, you know,
go to take Beaverhead Rock and Rattlesnake Cliff and Goose Lake and so forth off because the animal activists don't like it? I mean, I think it's just ridiculous. I'm sorry, but
from the testimony, it doesn't sound like you have a whole lot to worry about, Senator Whitfitt. Sounds like these things happen pretty slowly. Well, I'm going to go ahead and end the agony here and close the public hearing on this so-called chip shot bill here. House Bill 2245, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2279. Thank you, Mr. McCarthy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2279 comes to you from the Judiciary for the Judicial Department, allows the juvenile court to conduct reviews and guardianship reports, allows for flexibility regarding timelines into which local citizens review board when they report guardianship cases.
Doki, welcome to the committee, Ms. Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Nancy Miller. I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator for Program Operations for the Judicial Department, and I was going to take my seat and tell you how easy this bill was going to be, but now I will not dare do so. This is a very complex bill that makes two fixes. It's a result of Senate Bill 70, the guardianship bill last session. There was an inadvertent omission in that bill to allow the juvenile court, when it reviews a guardianship report, to set a hearing on its own motion. So this bill allows the court to do that. Guardianship report comes in. The judge sees some concerns and can set the matter for hearing and bring the family in to talk about how things are going. When we wrote the bill last time also, we had a 45-day timeline for review by the Citizen Review Board if the court gave that review responsibility to the CRB. And what we found when we tried to implement this on the ground is that in some of our smaller communities where the board only meets quarterly, like Lake County, for example, we could not make the 45-day timeline. So rather than asking the volunteers to come in special for one case, this bill allows us to set a guardianship review in the regularly scheduled course of review by the Citizen Review Board. And those are the only two changes the bill makes. Happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions from the committee? Okay. That is an excellent sign today.
Thank you.
We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2279 and open a work session on House Bill 2279. Senator Starr.
Chair, move House Bill 2279 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2279 to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer, would you like to carry this? You haven't had your turn yet, Senator Beyer. It's penance for the last bill here. Okay.
Now he has to pay attention.
Okay.
2281.
Okay. We'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2281. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 2281 comes to you from the Judiciary Committee of the Judiciary for the Judicial Department. Modifies provisions governing circuit courts and appellate courts relating to fees for administrative services, interpreters, and jurors. Kingsley Click is here to testify on behalf of the bill.
Come on up.
Good afternoon. For the record, Kingsley Click, State Court Administrator. And then I want to invite Nancy Miller to come up and deliver the testimony since she did so well in the last bill of ours.
You think she's your good luck charm?
She's a good luck charm. This is our housekeeping bill that we usually have each session where we've asked the courts during the following previous spring to identify issues in the statutes that need clarification and have created some problems in their courts over the past several years. So this bill does three things. It clarifies that the Chief Justice has the same authority as he does for the circuit courts to set a schedule of miscellaneous fees in the appellate courts and for materials and services in the Office of the State Court Administrator. examples of those which are published in our fee schedule are things like returning insufficient check charge, copy fees, things like that, which are 25 cents a page. There have been some problems in the past because the state court administrator is also the clerk of the appellate courts, and so there are things that the statutes govern about charges for that, and then there's things where we're the administrative entity for the state court system, and we get asked for copies or for various items, and those aren't really covered well by that statute. So this provides the Chief Justice with the same authority to set those by Chief Justice order as he does for the circuit courts. Then there's a clarification of procedures for substituting interpreters in the court. The clarification is just that the substitution process must follow the court procedures. It was unclear before when there was a qualified interpreter that the parties objected to for one reason or another about how they would go about substituting that, and that section just says it they can still go through the substitution, but it goes through the court procedures. The last part is with our jury lists, our master jury lists. This one I hope is pretty straightforward as well. Just provides explicitly in statute that once we are preparing our source list and our term list, that we can continue to update addresses and also remove names of persons who are deceased or permanently ineligible for jury service. The reason that we've asked for that to be in statute is because the courts, because of the number of jury challenges that we have had through the years and continue to have on the jury lists and how those are compiled, there's been a concern even for taking the names off of people who have died once we've received notice of that, because they don't want in any way to have made an administrative change. So this sets it out in statute, and we have procedures for doing that. And that's really the sum and substance of this bill. Passed the House, I think, with one no vote, and otherwise did not have material issues raised.
How does one become permanently ineligible?
We've had issues of people who are maybe physically or mentally incapacitated for life. And so the parent or the guardian will write and say, my person is in an Alzheimer's unit, and please excuse him for jury service. And they provide the information, then they get excused, and then a year later they get called again. And so it's part of its public relations, is you get people who don't understand, once they provided valid documentation, why they or their loved ones have to keep going through this time and time again. We just had one last week from Lane County where a poor person's wife was deceased and wrote and said, how can I keep us from having to keep having, you know, these summons come? And I provided the information to the elector, and I provided it to DMV, but by the time we had our list, we didn't have any DMV notice of death.
So permanently ineligible, and then what's the difference between permanently ineligible and permanently excused? Who would be permanently excused?
Well, ineligible has to do with qualifications. Permanently excused is someone who maybe is, I'm just trying to think of them, other than you could have a, it could also be an illness or a situation. It could also be moved to another country, sort of thing.
Council?
Madam Chairman, as a committee, I think one example of probably being permanently ineligible would be someone who had their citizenship revoked. You have to be a citizen of the United States to be on jury duty. And say, for example, you came into the country, became a citizen, and it turned out that you were fraudulent, your citizen application.
Okay. Chair Burdick, Committee Council, that's an excellent example, because the eligibility is you must be a U.S. citizen, though we get our lists also from DMV, where we have the identification list, so not all people on that list would necessarily be citizens and emerge with a voter the elector list. The other is that you must reside in the county, though that would be permanently ineligible. Well, you'd be ineligible while you're in that county. And must be 18 and older.
Convicted felons.
Convicted felons who've not had their rights restored. So.
Okay. So they can't serve on jury just like they can't vote.
Correct. Until they've restored their civil rights. Yeah. They've served their imprisonment on probation.
They're not permanently.
Right. How long is it?
Only when they're in custody, under control.
Okay, or on parole. Right. Okay. All right.
Except for the criminal list, and they can't serve if they have a conviction. For criminal juries, they can still serve on civil if they've had their rights restored.
Huh. Always a good opportunity to have an education. Senator Pozanski.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I've got one question. Looking at the changing of the fees, and I don't know if there's any questions that came up before. Looking at the statute currently, there's a maximum of 25 cents per page. But reading it as how this would be rewritten, it would be a maximum of 25 cents per page or the actual cost of producing the copy, whichever is greater. Who's going to determine what the cost is if it's greater than the 25 cents that's standard now?
Senator Burdick, Senator Pozanski. It's the Chief Justice's order, and right now there's a... a policy that sets forth how you calculate someone's time if it's in addition. And I think you've had another bill. I know it's been other Judiciary Committee that's talked about how public records requests are handled and how you calculate time in addition to a copy. So it's not so much the per page thing, but it's the additional time if you've had to have legal counsel go in and redact personal information before the public record is provided, or others. You can charge for the person's time. You can't charge a profit, but you can charge at your actual costs in addition to the per page.
Well, that could be quite a substantial fee.
You have to provide notice of what it is before you do it, and that there's not another way to satisfy that same request. One example would be phone records, where someone's requested a judge's phone records, and there's certain, you can redact certain personal information from those records before they're provided.
So this is only for public records requests?
That's been our copy fees. The only other thing has been mailing. And the Chief Justice order has a fee set for actual cost for mailing. So if we had a request for 500 pages to be mailed to New York City, then we would have the 25 cents per page plus the actual cost of mailing and delivery.
Yeah. Okay. Did you, Council?
Madam Chair, I need a clarification. I see this as being any copy that's being asked for, not public question, not public records request, not redacting information. This is just for someone sticking a statute book or a court document on a photocopier and punching the button. And I have a real problem with this. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is an open-ended. We can charge whatever we want if we can justify that we think it costs that much for something as simple as making copies.
And under current law, it's a straight 25 cents per page?
Senator Burdick, it is not. It's a different statute that we, when there's public records requests, allow you to charge your actual costs, and so we use that one. This was just trying to put it all in one place to clarify how we distinguish our records from what the appellate court records are doing.
Senator Pozanski.
Yeah, but Madam Chair, I think the problem here at Kingsley is that when you put this into 21.020, mm-hmm. you're now setting it where what I would consider a standard operating cost for the clerk of the court to go pull a file out off the shelf, make the copies, and charge 25 cents per page mm-hmm. to potentially saying it cost us this amount of money to go downstairs to get this out of archives or whatever it might be, and all of a sudden now we're charging individuals that are getting court records
more than, I understand the issue when you're talking about public record request, you're going in and generating new documents or going through and making sure something is appropriate for release to the public that may have some type of protection. But stuff that's, for the most part, I would think it's in the court clerk's office under files is going to be public records, and it should not have the ability that this would allow for, I mean, let's just say you have somebody that is more of a thorn in dealing with, that comes and makes requests for documents. I could see where this could be used by a clerk if they chose to try to get someone from, let's say, making as many requests for copies of court records. I've got some concerns. It just seems to me that we're maybe in efficiency trying to put everything in one place in the statute, but its ability to be used more broadly than what might be intended is going to be right there in the statute.
Senator Burdick, Senator Brzezinski, this does not apply to the circuit courts. There's a separate statute on that. And it was meant to mainly apply just the main offices, not to any court records that were specific to a court case. We could look at making that more clear, because the intent had been to provide in statute the same flexibility that there is in the local courts to respond to public records, but to try and separate the office of the state court administrator's records from the appellate court records. I can try and craft something that would make that.
Yeah, I think that would be helpful, because it does look very broad the way it's worded. Counsel?
Ms. Glick, I take it that you also get requests for the names of prospective jurors. Am I correct?
Senator Burdick, Chair Taylor, yes.
And does that require you to redact any information, or do you give the requester everything that, for example, I assume would be the juror's name, their address? Mm-hmm. Occupation?
Chair Burdick, Counsel Taylor, there's a specific statute in Chapter 10 for procedure where people who would like to have copies of the juror list, they have to go to the court and provide certain documentation, and then there's usually a protective order. So the jury lists to date have gone through a separate process for requesting and release, and not under this.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, why don't you try to work with counsel and narrow this down to what you're really talking about, so it doesn't look like it's applying to everything.
Okay. And it might be helpful if we put in a cross-reference to the other statute that we use for public records and clarify that it's that narrow.
So we can see, so it can be transparent of what we're adding.
We'd be happy to do that.
Thank you. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2281. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2268. Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 2268 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission and requires that if an appraisal and commendation acts and relies on a written report, opinion, or estimate of a person who is not an appraiser, then the appraisal must have an attached copy of the report, opinion, or estimate. It requires that appraisal relies on an unwritten report, opinion, or estimate of a person who is not an appraiser, then the name and address of the person who provided information must be included. Madam Chairman of the committee, I understand that if you are an appraiser, you, it's part of your licensing requirements. I believe you're supposed to give a written report, too.
Okay. Wendy Johnson and Paul Snyder. We'll call him later if he's here. If he's not, he's out of luck. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Wendy Johnson with the Oregon Law Commission. This is a eminent domain bill from the Law Commission that comes from our eminent domain work group. Some of you may remember that we had a number of eminent domain bills last year, and this work group has continued. We have two bills in the process this session. This is the simpler of the two. This bill is really like a math problem. If you're a middle school student is writing a math problem, if they just write the answer, the math teacher won't give you credit. This bill would require the same kind of thing. You're required to give an appraiser to a property owner when the government condemns your property, and that appraisal provides a number, and that helps you decide whether the offer given by the government is a reasonable offer. But it's difficult to decide whether that offer is reasonable if you don't have all the documents and attachments that went into that appraisal that the appraiser's providing to you. So this bill would require that any report, opinion, or estimate that was relied upon by the appraiser in writing that appraisal also be attached and provided with the appraisal. In a condemnation case, the main issue of the case is how much the property is worth. And different than other areas of law, statute already requires you to provide a copy of the appraisal, both the property owner 60 days before trial, and the government has to provide their copy of an appraisal along with their offer. So both sides have to provide appraisals to the other side. This just requires you to also provide the work, the explanation. It will help settle these cases quicker. It puts everybody on the same page so that settlement can be done easier. And it was a consensus bill. We had members from the government side as well as the property owner side on this work group. We also had federal Judge Levy on this project, and we had a couple of appraisers also who participated. It's a good bill that helps the process and provides more information. It doesn't add extra cost either, because it only requires you to provide any reports that were already prepared. If there is not a written report, but yet you did receive information, say, from a mineral expert or an engineer, you got some dollar figure, you need to at least write down the name and an address of that person, so if the other side wants to find out more information, they can. So that's what this bill is about. It received unanimous voting from the Land Use Committee over on the House side, as well as nearly unanimous floor vote from the House. Representative Burley did vote against this bill. He would have liked to have amended the bill with combining another bill with this one. The committee did not agree to add that on.
Combining another bill or an amendment?
Providing an amendment. Mm-hmm.
And then I'm trying to figure out what the amendment in the House did. This was amended in the House?
Yes, Senator Burdick. It was just the word served, I believe, was changed to provided, because you don't serve appraisals. You just provide them to the other side. So no. It was just that word.
Okay.
But the any amendment to change the purpose of the bill was rejected. In other words, combining Representative Burley's bill with this bill was rejected, that part of an amendment.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Welcome, Mr. Snyder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and we concur with the logic behind the bill and the comments from Ms. Johnson. Just simply add that it seems to advance the notion of the previous revisions, and that is full and timely disclosure of all the information that you used to come up with a dollar figure, and that's helpful to both sides.
Okay, thank you. We had the same person, as I understand, who had tried to get the amendment in the House is wanting to do the same thing in the Senate. Is that correct? And he's not here right now. Are you well enough informed to go over for us, or we probably should wait to hear from him?
Senator Burdick, I'd prefer to wait, because I'm not sure exactly how that amendment concept has progressed, but correct. I believe Mr. Willis is in another committee, but Joe Willis did intend to testify today.
He did not?
He did.
Yeah, okay. Yes, good. He signed up. Okay, any other questions from the committee? We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2268. And we will withhold final action on this. I want to hear what Mr. Willis has to say, but he's not here, so he'll just have to get around to us individually. And we are through our agenda, I believe, so Senate Judiciary is adjourned.